You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, August 4th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And Evan Bernstein.
Well, hello. And where's Jay?
Jay is in Sweden hunting the Yeti.
Is that what they're calling it these days?
Swedish Yeti?
Jay, we miss you. Come home soon.
Yeah, get back here. Don't make us do all the work.
So what do you got for us today, Evan?
It was August 7th, 1926. And do you guys remember the story of the midwife toad research?
No.
Probably don't.
No.
Midwife toad research done by Paul Kammerer was debunked in an article on August 7th, 1926, published by G. Kingsley Noble. Kammerer was a Viennese biologist who alleged his research supported the Lamarckian theory of inheritance, which is a theory that predates Darwin's theories of evolution and so forth.
And it was predates kind of Lamarck, too.
From the 1700s, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Well, in 1918, Kammerer, when he was doing his research, he claimed that in his experiments with midwife toads, he had induced nuptial pads that were subsequently hereditary.
Wait, what's a midwife toad? Is that a toad that helps other toads have babies?
You'd think so. It's just a species of toad.
Okay.
I don't know the scientific name of it.
I was seriously confused, and I'm sorry to admit that, but I really was.
That's okay. Now, here's the rest of the story, though. So this fellow, Noble, he was a curator at the American Museum of Natural History, and he examined the preserved specimen of Kammerer's midwife toad and found that the nuptial pad had been simulated with injected Indian ink. So it was a hoax.
A hoax toad.
Uh-huh. So it wasn't a matter of characteristic of inheritance. It was, in fact, fraud. At the time, it set off an academic bombshell pretty big from the readings from 1926. So big that 6 weeks later, Kammerer committed suicide.
Wow.
Really?
Deal with the shame and ignominy of it all.
See, that's what scientific fraud got you. Huh?
So don't fake your science research, everyone out there.
That's right. Well, let's go on to a few news items. Let's hope this one isn't fraud. Japanese researchers have published a study demonstrating that they were able to grow bioengineered teeth in adult mice. Pretty cool.
Awesome.
What they did was they took the teeth seeds, right, the cells that would be the seeds that would later grow into teeth from a mouse embryo, implanted it in the jawbone of an adult mouse, and the tooth seeds grew into functional teeth with a nerve and sensation and everything.
Is this like grown on the back of the mouse? The ears were? Or this was in the mouth of the mouse?
In the jaw. Yeah. Choppers. They were actually able to use them.
Aren't they? I saw a picture, and it looked like it was glowing in the dark.
Oh, really?
Is that true? Did it glow in the dark? I don't know. Maybe that was a Photoshop picture. It was bizarre.
Yes, the bioengineered tooth was labeled with green fluorescence protein so they can track where the cells from the tooth germ were going.
Yeah.
So this is it's a nice development, but it's incremental. It's this kind of technology might eventually lead to, you know, obviously replacing lost or damaged or malformed teeth. However, we have not yet identified the cells in a human embryo that will give rise to adult teeth. So we have more knowledge in this area about mice than we do about people. So we could not do at this time the same thing in a person. But, you know, if this procedure works in a mouse, eventually we should be able to figure it out and make it work in a human.
And also for other organs and things, right? I mean, this isn't just teeth.
Yeah,
can't this have applications?
Absolutely.
Elsewhere.
And that's again further down the line, but the same concept of taking, you know, precursor cells or tissue destined to later develop into an organ, transplanting them into an adult and regrowing a liver or regrowing a heart or a kidney or whatever it is that you, whatever organ's failing or that you need to replace. Of course, this would be optimal if we could take, not do it with an embryo, but again, like take adult cells from you, give it the properties of embryonic cells, get it to develop into the precursor of the desired organ and then transplant your own organ back into you, right? Mm. That would be the ultimate goal.
Yes, that would be great.
Yeah, you would have your own organ.
Steve, the article says here that by day 37 after the transplantation, the researchers noticed the bioengineered teeth were beginning to show and so forth. Now, so 37 days later, I mean, so what are we talking about? How long, you know, are people going to have to wait for these organ farms essentially to grow? I guess it depends on the complexity of what exactly it is you're trying to grow.
Yeah, and probably not as long as they're waiting on organ transplant waiting lists as it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
These things are long and deadly.
I was a little disappointed, though. The article just seemed to end, and my question was, well, what's next? This is really interesting. You know, what organs are you going to try next, and can we transition this to, like Steve said, to use skin-derived stem cells or something like that? They just I looked around. I didn't find too much more yet being released about this, but I'm just dying to see what organs they're going to try next. I assume they use teeth. I'm not sure why did they do teeth first. Was it because of their structural simplicity, and now they'll go to the more complex organs? I'm not sure, but wow, this really seems to have some potential to it.
I think they started with teeth so that they could meet the growing demand in the wrapper market for growing like a fresh new grill.
Think so?
Phosphorescent teeth or like gold teeth. Yeah, that's big money there.
Does that mean I can stop flossing now?
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Grow a third pair?
Get to 40 or whatever and you just grow all new teeth, start from scratch.
Don't sharks have indefinite amounts of teeth?
Yes, they do. And it's an old story with the Novella family. I remember hearing my grandmother say years ago that she had, I think it was her grandfather, that actually had a third set of teeth when he lost all his teeth at like whatever age it was. A new, brand spanking new set of teeth came in. Third set, and it was complete.
Yeah,
I'd like to have seen his x-rays.
Your ancestors are creepy.
Yeah, that's a nice one. Like, So when I was at the dentist, I took a close look at my x-rays. Like, damn, I don't see a third set in there.
Oh, wow. But you could, now we might be able to do that artificially. That would be awesome.
Can we stop talking about teeth now? I'm having my wisdom teeth out tomorrow, and I'd like to kind of forget about it.
You'll lose 4 points of wisdom if you get those teeth out.
That puts me at like -3.
You're going to do it without anesthesia?
Oh, yeah. I'm a tough one. So
you're going to tough it out?
Yeah, are you kidding, man? I'm going to be so doped up. I'm going to look like friggin' Whitney Houston.
That's before you get to the office.
You don't want to put any artificial chemicals in your body, do you, Rebecca?
Yeah.
No, that's true. I don't.
Pain is natural, yeah.
It's kind of like childbirth.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It'll be a good dry run for your children.
Oh, right, for all those spawn I'm going to be popping out anytime now that I'm married.
One more quick bit of stem cell news. This one is kind of good news. I've spoken a couple of times on the show before about the fact that there is a proliferation of fraudulent stem cell clinics popping up around the world. A lot are in China. There's some in India and even Mexico now. They'll happily take $20,000+ from desperate people who have incurable diseases and then claim to treat them with stem cells. Well, recently, Hungary's health ministry announced that they raided a stem cell clinic, a quote-unquote stem cell clinic, that was doing fraudulent treatment. And they say that they hope that this scares others from offering untested treatments and will be a cautionary tale to members of the public. Well, I hope that it is. Of course, you could say that about just about all of alternative medicine.
Yeah, that's right? For sure.
Yeah, it surprises me that it's in Hungary. I guess I always pictured them as like seedy shacks in third world countries that people went to. But
unfortunately, some of them are sponsored by like actual hospitals. And in China, the suspicion is that the government is happily sponsoring these clinics. It brings in a lot of money and prestige, so why not?
Oh, wow, with the full weight and power of a government behind an operation like this, that's very scary.
Yeah.
Terrible. But it's good to see at least one of these clinics got raided, and hopefully it's also the first time I've seen in a mainstream, this is in Reuters, a mainstream news outlet running a story that these clinics are essentially not promoting these clinics, but saying that, hey, they're fraudulent, because previously the only stories I've seen were discussing the fact that, look at this kid was cured by these stem cells from this wonderful clinic in China. You should go there,
Yeah.
Bob, you're going to tell us about the next news item about laser propulsion.
Yeah, this was I've heard about this before for many years actually, but it does look like now potentially that chemical rockets may have some stiff competition in the future if Lake Mirabeau has his way. He's an aerospace engineer at the RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in the United States, and his specialties are energy applications, aerospace systems, and advanced propulsion. Now, he sees a future for non-chemical propulsion, and I hope he's right, because chemical rockets are just too expensive, in my opinion, too inefficient, and they're just not science fiction-y enough for my 2009 taste. You know, if we can't have jetpacks, we can't have flying cars in 2009, let's at least have some really wicked rocket technology.
The problem with all of those things, the problem with rockets and jetpacks and whatever, is that you have to carry your fuel with you.
Yes.
And whenever you need fuel in order to carry fuel, you get to that rocket equation where it just becomes prohibitive, you know?
And this is one of the things that laser propulsion can actually deal with. He's been working on this for about 30 years. It was introduced in 1972 by Arthur Kantrowitz. And if you're not familiar with it, it's a form of beam-powered propulsion in which the source of energy is...
Did you say beam-powered?
Beam.
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 Oh, okay. As in Jim Beam.
That makes more sense.
The source of the energy is separate from the reaction mass, which is what Steve was talking about there. That's the key thing right there. Now, for chemical rockets, everything is right there. It's all right there on the rocket. But for the laser propulsion, they typically use a ground-based laser or a maser now. I recently found out that they're kind of moving more towards the microwave maser rather than just the regular laser.
Bob, are sharks involved at any point in this process?
Are they on their frickin' heads?
Sharks?
Sharks with laser beams on their heads.
Where the hell did that come from?
Oh, Bob.
Oh, Bob.
What the hell did I miss? It didn't seem like I missed much. But
you missed Austin Powers.
Austin Powers.
Oh, my God. Wow. Yeah. Okay. So they direct the laser or maser. They direct it towards the funnel-shaped craft. And inside, on the inside, there's a parabolic reflector that focuses the light to a point which heats the air, and it just kind of just blows it up. It gets to about 30,000 degrees. Now, I don't know if that's Celsius or Fahrenheit, but I don't think it really matters because it's really, really damn hot. So it just explodes the air, basically. And that's what thrusts the rocket. That's what sends the rocket up and out through the atmosphere. They also need nitrogen jets to spin the craft. And this guy, Mirabeau, is spinning it at 6,000 RPMs, which is pretty fast, but also will make the craft very, very stable. Now, obviously, this guy's pretty gung-ho about this. He told Space.com recently that typically a new propulsion technology takes 25 years to mature. It takes 25 years historically to the point where you can actually field it. Well, that time is now, says Mirabeau. He's apparently one of the big milestones for this technology is a drop in the cost to just about a couple dollars per watt of laser energy. And he says, we're here now. It's a matter of will and do we want to do it? This technology is now at the cusp of commercial reality. All that's needed now is to actually build them. The problem has evolved from a scientific one to an engineering one. Clearly, it seems that we've passed a milestone in this research. And according to Mirabeau, at least, he thinks that it's really just the engineering details now to really get this thing going.
Although sometimes, often, in fact, the engineering, quote-unquote, details, that's where the devil is, right? I mean, that's where the problem is.
That's the not dying while you've got a jetpack strapped to your back.
Right. I mean, that's a non-trivial aspect of translating concepts into products, and you know what I mean, is the whole industrialization and engineering part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the skeptics for light propulsion kind of alluded to that. Phil Coyle is a former top technology tester for the Pentagon. He told Wired .com last year that researchers have been trying with little success to scale this technology, and that's one of the major problems, and it's primarily due to major limitations of the power of the lasers, the size of the craft, and the limited propellants that they carry. But let me quickly just go into what, if Mirabeau's vision comes to fruition, what we could potentially see from this technology. Initially, I think we could see the launching of nano and micro satellites. Ever hear of nano satellites? These range from one to 100 kilograms. Potentially, we could see a savings of a thousandfold reduction in the cost per pound to put this stuff into orbit, which would be quite amazing. But further down the line, Mirabeau sees that we could even potentially replace commercial jet travel. People could be flown to the other side of the planet in under an hour. That's pretty damn fast. I wonder if this will be ready for our Australia trip next year. I hope so. Mirabeau also talks about power stations in space beaming down energy to electrically propel cars and trains, and even for heating and cooling. So clearly, this could have some potential. But I think it remains to be seen if this can happen, if it really can scale as he says. It could scale, and if it really is just the little engineering details. So keep an eye out for that one. This guy seems pretty confident. This guy clearly has the expertise in the field. He's probably one of the few people around that actually has all the expertise required, you know, to doing the research for 30 years in this laser propulsion. Yeah, right. But still, argument from authority is still an argument from authority. But we'll see if this pans out. And I hope he's right, because this would be anything that could reduce launch to orbit cost is awesome in my book, especially thousandfold reduction would be awesome. I just want to get there.
That's even better than a space elevator, isn't it? A thousandfold. Not that we're anywhere near a space elevator.
There are
non-trivial engineering problems there.
Yeah, and a space elevator wouldn't get me a jetpack. Like that's all. I don't really care about getting into space and stuff. I just want to cruise around with my jetpack. Mm-hmm. I think it's 2009. It's high time.
It is. But have you seen the water pack?
I was about to bring that up. Actually, I love that, and that's only like $20,000 or so.
But you could fly for quite a long time, almost as
long as you have ocean,
right?
Only over the ocean. Yeah.
It sucks up the water, right, and uses that as propulsion. So as soon as you like venture over dry land, you're pretty much effed. But
Rebecca, what if the jetpack requires that you have to wear a device on your belt? You know, like a small, like a cell phone. Will that put a kibosh on it?
I would have to seriously consider my sartorial choices, because
good word.
I'm not wearing a fanny pack.
By the way, did you see the utility belts that Fernanda sent us?
Yes.
Yes.
That was
yes.
embarrassing. Like, oh my God.
Yeah, so listener Fernanda sent us a link to a company that sells what they're calling utility belts. They even reference Batman, but they're glorified fanny packs.
Oh,
they really
it
are.
Is fanny with a capital F. And I just like saying fanny a lot because I know it makes our Australian listeners laugh.
Yeah. Or is it the UK listeners?
I don't know if they have the same term in the UK. Maybe they do. No,
I'm pretty sure. Hmm. You're right. I'm sure they laugh every time we say
fanny pack. I think they call
it
a bum buddy.
A bum buddy. In
England.
it is. It's bum pack or something. Yeah.
But Rebecca, why would that be especially humorous in Australia?
Well, in Australia and possibly England, fanny does not mean butt. It means same general area, but in the front of a lady.
Oh, interesting.
Really?
Well, thanks, Fernanda, but we're not quite there yet with the skeptical utility belt, though. But nice try. Quick update on Simon Singh. Remember that Simon Singh was sued by the British Chiropractic Association for saying that they are promoting bogus therapies, which is, in fact, the truth. But the English libel laws are so terrible that he is having a hard time defending himself. And in that system, he's guilty until proven innocent. An initial decision that was passed down, I think, about a month or so ago now, put him in a very awkward position in which he had to defend the meaning of his statement about the British Chiropractic Association, saying that they were committing conscious fraud, that they were deliberately misrepresenting their therapies, which is not what he intended to say. He was just saying that there's no evidence that their therapies work, without trying to guess or infer what they actually believe. But the judge is going to make him defend the claim that they believed that their therapies don't work and promoted them anyway. Well, as we had stated previously, Simon was appealing that decision. And unfortunately, a couple days ago, he was turned down by the Court of Appeal, which I actually think he was not given the right to appeal, right? You need to get a permission to appeal, and that was declined to him.
Correct. And right. Yeah, he has 7 days from the time that he's served, apparently, in which he can make a decision of whether or not to ask for an oral renewal hearing. The crazy thing is, like, come on, England. This is so effed up. Not only was he denied the permission to appeal, but he wasn't actually served with the denial, the refusal, because there was a strike on. The Postal Service was striking in London. And so the letters were sent out. Apparently, they were sealed on the 30th of July, but he hadn't received them. I'm not sure if he's even gotten them yet. Like, he was still waiting, at last I heard on Monday, I think. He was still waiting to receive the actual refusal. So, but once he, so this is like grapevine, sort of. That's how he knows that he was refused. But once he receives the official refusal, he has 7 days to decide whether or not he wants to make an oral renewal.
Mm-hmm.
So
another option. So this is from the Jack of Kent blog, who is a skeptic and I guess also a legal expert, who's been following this case, and he says that another option that Simon may have is to challenge the notion that the British Chiropractic Association has the right to sue for libel because they are not a stockholder organization, and that apparently corporations cannot sue for defamation.
Hmm.
They may be able to go that route. And as we said previously, if all that fails, he may then appeal to the European Union for a violation of his civil rights. But we'll see. We also have to see how far he can argue. He's, you know, this is a very expensive endeavor to keep this going, you know, appeal after appeal after appeal. We'll see how far he can go with it.
And luckily, I think that there are hordes of skeptics standing by ready to donate whatever
yeah.
he needs.
Yeah.
So hopefully he's able to keep going. I think that more than the, I mean, yeah, the costs are outrageous. But I think more than that is just the emotional roller coaster that all of this has got to be, you know,
mm-hmm.
he, like the last time I spoke with Simon, he was in such good spirits and he's such like, he's just an awesome guy. And he was just like, no, I'm really kind of enjoying this in a weird way. But that was way back at the very beginning. And I can't imagine that it's easy to
right.
keep going, you know, keep slogging through all this. But
the good right. news is this is a PR disaster for the British Chiropractic Association. I think they may be wearying of this process as well. And, you know, Jack of Kent also points out another wrinkle in this case that I had alluded to previously when we were talking about the fact that the British Chiropractic Association printed they came out with their, oh, here are 29 or whatever studies which support our claims. Turns out a lot of them had nothing to do with their claims, and the others were, you know, a few, you know, very bad studies for each specific claim that they were promoting, you know, basically chiropractic for certain childhood indications like asthma or ear infections. And they cherry-picked. They left out the large, better quality studies that, in fact, were negative. That was a bit of deception on their part, to cherry-pick and misrepresent the literature on those very questions, which they systematically did. That actually may count against them. Just, you know, Jack of Kent is saying that Simon's actually in a better position after the BCA came out with their crappy list of cherry-picked studies, because that could be used as evidence for conscious deception, that, you know, cherry-picking and misrepresenting the scientific evidence. So, I don't know. We'll see.
I hope cherry-picking isn't too subtle for them to latch on to, because that's something that's
yeah.
easy just to not really catch.
When there's a big, well-designed negative study, and you don't mention it, though, I don't know.
That's, I hope you're right.
That's at least to me, that's pretty obvious. But you're right. Who knows what will happen in the legal system? Well, let's go on to a few of your questions and emails. The first email comes from Aaron Kren, who writes actually a very interesting email. He writes, "I'm a Christian, and I've started to listen to some of your podcasts. I also lived in Grand Rapids for a while, so I found it interesting to hear you talk about the area, such as churches like Mars Hill. I visited there a couple times, but became a member of a smaller independent church. I'm listening to discover more about what atheists and skeptics believe. I figure that if what I believe is true, then there ought to be proper responses to what you believe. I find your podcast challenging, but good in giving me a greater desire to dive deeper into what I believe. I think it is true that many Christians don't have a deep understanding of their faith. I also think, because it has been true of me, that Christians are often segregated in their own communities and don't rub shoulders enough with people who aren't Christians. It really is amazing to see how wholeheartedly people believe in different things. I found it refreshing to hear you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you don't follow the postmodern perspective that there is only one truth and that belief is subjective. It makes sense that if the whole universe relies on laws and scientific facts, that the same should also be true for issues of spirituality. I know you don't believe in spiritual things or God, but if God were real, would you say that not all belief systems would work equally in connecting with God and living the way he desires? I'm just curious as to what you would say. I have one other question. I don't necessarily mean it to be a got you question, but I am curious about what your view is. If evolution is true, where did the first particles of matter from which all life evolved come from? You've probably answered this many times, and you've no doubt thought about it and researched it as best as you can. I admit I haven't yet taken the time to research the common beliefs about the subject, but I thought this would be a good place to start. He mentions a couple other things, but to cut it short, he just concludes with thanks, Aaron. So I found this email very interesting. First of all, I always like to see people branching out from their very narrow, insular, intellectual world and, you know, saying, hey, what do other people actually believe? You know, rather than just accepting what you're told from secondary, often hostile sources that they believe, right?
And
absolutely. So got to give him props for that. You know, he's listening to our show to find out what we actually have to say. And it sounds like he's thinking about it because he says he found it challenging, which means he's not dismissing it all out of hand. So that's good. I also think that his observations about Christians is not in any way unique to Christians. I think that pretty much every ideological community does that. But that's partly the nature of confirmation bias, is that we seek out sources and opinions would reinforce what we already believe, and that could become very insular.
Yeah, and the internet makes it even easier. You know, you find forums and podcasts and communities that fit whatever narrow thing you're interested in. So yeah, it is always good to hear from people who believe in something a little different.
Right. And I agree with his logic in that certainly we believe there's one reality, and that's why all of science needs to agree with itself, right? Because it all needs to fit together. You can't have two scientific conclusions that are mutually exclusive and yet both be correct. You know, if they're mutually exclusive, one or both needs to be wrong because it is just describing the same reality. So if we did live in a universe with a God, then sure, if that were part of reality, then yeah, it would, whatever facts there were about the existence of such a being would have to be internally consistent, and yeah, there couldn't be mutually exclusive belief systems that were both quote unquote true. Of course, you know, again, the thing I can kind of see where he's going there, but he also has to accept the fact that if you have two belief systems that are mutually exclusive, one or both need to be wrong. So he's trying to, I think, lead himself to the conclusion that there's only one true faith. But you can also conclude from that, well, because so many faiths are mutually incompatible, it could be that they're all wrong, right? You also have to accept that possibility as well. But of course, this is all hypothetical. The nature of most of the types of things that religions believe in is that they're not falsifiable and they're matters of faith and not objective knowledge. Which leads to the big difference between science and religion is when there are two mutually exclusive conclusions in science, there are objective ways in order to resolve the conflict. You could bring, you know, evidence and logic to bear in order to say that one of those views is correct, for example. But with matters of faith, when there is mutually exclusive belief systems, there is no objective way for resolution to resolve which one is correct or which one is better. But to get to his second question about where did the matter come from, we have touched upon this question from a couple of different angles before, and we do like to point out that the origin of stuff, you know, where matter came from in the universe, even the origin of life itself, is a separate question from the evolution of life. So once life arose, life is subject to evolutionary processes, and the evidence overwhelmingly shows that, in fact, over the last 4 billion years, life has evolved.
Yeah, I suspect that, you know, this is such a common argument, or it's not even really an argument, but it's a common thing for creationists to say. And I wonder if it's not just a simple confusion over Darwin's origin of species. They they see the word origin and just assume that what he's talking about is the origin of life, when in fact he's talking about how do we get these distinct species, how do we get a bird and a monkey, and you know, were they at some point in the distant past connected? As opposed to, yeah, what is the origin of things that live?
Yeah, and in terms of, and he's bringing it back even to the origin of matter, which goes back to the Big Bang.
Right.
You know, just the origin of the energy and matter that makes up our universe. And we're just starting to even think about the cosmology of, you know, we know that, or at least there's a very strong theory with a lot of explanatory power and evidence to back it up, that something like the Big Bang happened, the, you know, the origin of the space-time continuum, right, our universe.
But Steve, another just a quick little point I'd like to say, that I think we've mentioned this earlier as well, but the idea of matter and how it just seems not to make sense that matter can appear out of nothing, but that's actually a straw man. Science really isn't telling us that it came from absolutely nothing.
Right.
Because one way to look at it, you could say that the positive energy of matter is equally balanced by the negative energy of gravity. So taking that together, the entire energy content of the universe is in fact zero. So in a sense, it's the ultimate free lunch. But I think that's an important point, because it doesn't necessarily come from nothing, and it's actually nothingness. It's matter and energy. When you put it all together with the gravity and matter, it really is nothing. So I guess you could say that sounds pretty magical in itself, but a lot of science does. But science does address that fact in that way, and it's just something I wanted to throw out there.
You're right, but from a math, the math adds up is what you're saying. But I think from a more cosmological, philosophical point of view, obviously there isn't nothing. The universe exists. There's something there, and it had to come from somewhere. The fact is we just don't know. I mean, we don't have – our cosmology is not advanced enough for us to even think about, you know, where did – you know, why isn't there nothing, and where did stuff come from?
But the wonderful thing is that there are scientists who are working on things that are so far beyond the imagination of so many people. And that to me is the unfortunate thing about creationism in general. Bob has a very good point in that these ideas are in a way magical, and they're really wonderful to think about and to imagine. But unfortunately, there's this subset of the population who, instead of delving into the great unknown and trying to answer the questions, simply answer it with, well, we will never know. So it must be a god, or it must be something. Instead of, well, I don't know, maybe we can figure it out. And, you know, I remember we talked a while back about scientists who are, you know, trying to get a peek into what might have existed prior to the Big Bang. And that was just it's so mind blowing to think that that's even plausible. Like, that's even something we could actually look into, you know?
We talked to Michio Kaku about string theory and membrane theory. I mean, right there, that opens multiple universes.
Right.
You know, and these are all legitimate scientific pursuits that he and his colleagues are going after. It's just beyond fascinating.
And it's so, you know, it is very difficult to understand and to wrap your mind around. And that's the problem, is this kind of argument from ignorance in a way. Like, I can't understand that, and therefore no one can understand that. We'll never understand that. That's the wrong attitude to have.
And if you're using this as an argument for why there is a God, that is a God of the gaps argument from ignorance. And it also doesn't solve anything. As you say, it just removes it one step. So if you say, okay, well, we don't know where the universe came from, therefore it was made by some God. Well, then where did God come from? Well, he always existed. Well, save the step and say whatever quantum fluctuation resulted in our universe, that always existed, or at least had a never-ending, you know, recession of antecedents. Although even more interesting is the possibility that our universe is finite but unbound temporally, and meaning that it may not even be a meaningful question to even ask what was there before the universe. There may not have been a before the universe, even though
because time is wrapped up in the universe.
Exactly. Time might be wrapped up in the same way that we are, our dimension, physical dimensions of our universe are wrapped up in that. There's no edge to it. You'll never get to the edge of the universe, but it isn't infinitely big. It's finite in size.
So if there was no time, then what could have changed to cause that quantum fluctuation? Your head, your brain kind of explodes when you think about that.
Well,
kind
yeah,
of stuff.
there's that idea of like...
Yeah, I shut down at that point.
Right. There's that theory that there's a possible universe out there that doesn't have a time dimension, and that
right.
our universe could suddenly flip over and become a universe like that without a time dimension. Like,
there is a universe out there in which Rebecca is the mother of 12 children. Isn't that
no, actually,
unbelievable?
That is
so cool.
That's this universe. I never really mentioned it before.
Right.
But we're
hopelessly decohered from that universe, right?
Hopefully.
Well, thanks for the question, Aaron. Keep listening and keep an open mind, right?
Yeah. Not so open that your brain falls out, though.
Right, that goes without saying. All right, one more question. This one's on interval training. This comes from Justin Larkham from Columbus, Ohio, and Justin writes, I subscribe to Popular Science, and perhaps my favorite thing about the magazine is the pseudoscientific advertising on the last few pages. This month I came across an exercise machine that looks more like a Rube Goldberg device than anything else. Anyway, the reason this particular ad caught my eyes, the major selling point of the thing is that it costs $14,615. Apparently, it's worth it because you only need to exercise 4 minutes a day. I thought you might like to check out the site. It's good for a laugh, and I thought it might make for a fun item to discuss on the show.
4 minutes? I don't have that kind of time.
Yeah.
I'd rather be fat.
This is interesting. I have no idea why this machine costs $14,615. I mean, that seems a bit excessive. You could buy a car for that money. Nobody.
It looks like a medieval torture device.
Yeah.
It does, yeah.
I mean, nobody needs to be spending that kind of money on an exercise machine, right?
But their point, though, Steve, is that it is so effective. 4 minutes that you're paying for that efficiency, and that it's worth it if you consider, why do you pay so much to fly to Florida when a bike would cost, you could pay less for a bike that would take you to Florida as well, but you're paying for the time savings of getting down there in a couple hours instead of a week. So
right.
that's the logic that they're working with here. That's why it's so expensive.
That's kind of
so
a dubious argument.
Absolutely.
That's ridiculous.
It looks like something that Dr. No would try to saw James Bond in half with.
But I will tell you, though, Steve, that if this thing truly did as they claimed, and that in 4 minutes a day I could have maximal cardiovascular benefits and other benefits, then I would argue that this would be worth it if it actually lived up to its claims, which is a big if.
That's a big if. So they're doing something that's very common in that they are saying, all right, this is the principle behind this is the so-called high-intensity interval training. And they link to research showing that this high-intensity interval training is effective in losing weight, improving cardiovascular function, oxygenation, whatever. However, I researched this pretty thoroughly, and actually I was surprised to find that most of the studies that I could find actually do favor the efficacy of this interval training, of high-impact interval training. So the comparison is between doing a moderate intensity continuous exercise versus intermittent high-intensity exercise. So basically working out harder for a minute and then at a lower level for a minute and then higher again for a minute or 2 minutes or 4 minutes or whatever. And apparently there are definite advantages to incorporating this high-intensity interval training into your exercising. It does cause some actual physiological changes that are advantageous. And probably what this is saying is that just having a low or moderate level of aerobic exercise doesn't really stimulate the physiological response to exercise maximally. However, if you then go look at the studies... for example, there was one study, and this was the one that I think was most often linked to in the when I was researching this. This was a study published recently that the title of which is Superior Cardiovascular Effect of Aerobic Interval Training versus Continuous Moderate Exercise in Patients with the Metabolic Syndrome. However, if you actually look at the study, the interval training had a 10-minute warm-up, followed by 4 4-minute intervals, and then with 3 minutes of active resting, they call it, in between. So you're still talking something like 37 or something, if I'm calculating that correctly, minutes of exercise compared to like 47 minutes of the moderate continuous exercise. Not 4 minutes, right? I mean, you can't then extrapolate from that, from, you know, doing, say, 30-something minutes of interval training versus 40-something minutes of continuous training, and then say, therefore, you can get those same benefits from just 4 minutes. No. I could not find anything to support that contention.
That's the crux of it. It seems like they're setting up a straw man of sorts where they're saying that, you know, on one hand, you've got this continuous moderate exercise, then you've got the interval training. I think it's clear that interval training is very effective and advantageous. Yeah. There's plenty of studies to show that, but that's not their core claim. For me, their core wacky claim is the whole 4 minute thing, which you just blew out of the water, because it's not, they're not doing 4 minutes. They got the warm up. They've got three or four series of 4 minutes. That's not what they're claiming. I mean, over and over in that website, they're saying 4 minutes. It's just 4 minutes, not multiple 4 minutes. And there was this one quote I got to read. It's such a classic straw man. They were talking about how experts, so-called experts like doctors and real physical trainers, how they just discount any new information with this. This is a parody of what they believe. They say, "I do not even have to waste my time looking into anything that differs with my knowledge and beliefs, because I know absolutely everything there is to be known about my field of knowledge. Therefore, anything that conflicts with my beliefs must be false." So that's their caricature of the mindset of doctors and physical trainers, and that's why they discount this whole idea of the 4 minute. I mean, if that's a nasty straw man. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, incredible. This is, especially in this field, is constantly changing. There's constant evidence from studies that are incorporated into what people do for their careers with tangible results. This is not status quo by any means.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a very active field of research, and people are changing their opinions based upon actual evidence, right? So they're, rather than providing evidence, They're linking to studies and referencing a research base that actually doesn't support their core claim, and then they're just dismissing criticism from, you know, they're disparaging experts, so these so-called experts, and just basically dismissing their criticism as being closed-minded.
And the other thing that's bothering me about this are these testimonials. That's sort of a red flag as far as I'm concerned, is when you put up a bunch of testimonials to help promote your product, where we know that testimonials are worthless when it comes to the scientific analysis of anything.
Yeah. The other way I think that the literature can get misrepresented is if you look at some studies, and there are some studies that did very short durations of exercise, like 8 minutes, I think was one study. So I didn't see anything that was as low as 4. And it does show that if you compare it to people who are doing no exercise,
right,
you know, and then you take people who do like this interval training for some modest amount of time, like 8 minutes, 3 days a week, they have what they can find a slight improvement, a small but statistically significant improvement, not a huge improvement. But some exercise, even a small amount of exercise, is better than absolutely nothing. The bottom line is, none of this supports this notion that you can exercise for 4 minutes, 3 days a week, and get all the advantages there is to get out of exercise. And certainly, none of that justifies this ridiculous $14,000 price tag for a piece of exercise equipment. Well, we're going to be joined now by Carrie, one of the skeptics, to talk about sexism in the skeptical movement. So let's go to that now. Joining us now is skeptic Carrie. Carrie, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, guys. Thanks.
And Rebecca asked you to come on to talk about a blog post that you wrote recently about your experiences and some thoughts from the amazing meeting 7 that we just had in July in Las Vegas. So tell us what you wrote about.
Well, I wrote a little blog post that kind of ended up causing a little bit more of a stir than I thought about Bill Prady's talk, and just generally relating that to some attitudes I've noticed in the skeptical movement toward women, and sort of trying to get at maybe some of the underlying things that keep women out of the movement.
And Bill Prady, to let people know who weren't at TAM, Bill Prady was the keynote speaker, who is the producer of The Big Bang Theory, an American television show.
Just to give you background, I had never seen the show before the talk, so I was kind of coming into it cold. You know, I didn't really have much context about the show, and they showed this series of clips that sort of set me up to have the reaction I did to his later comments. And it just seemed to me that every clip that was shown in the presentation, in every single one of them, a woman was either the butt of the joke or a beautiful woman that one of the characters is trying to impress is just so far outside of the realm of intelligence that the character is, that she can't relate to him at all. So in other words, like, you know, the sexy woman doesn't like the smart guy.
That definitely is one of the core themes of that show. Although she's almost the straight person on that show, at least in the later seasons, because the knowledge that the nerd characters come out with is ridiculously arcane. I mean, even a science enthusiast would find it incomprehensible much of the time, and it's deliberately so.
What I'm trying to get at is, yeah, I'm not going to try and deconstruct a silly sitcom and think that it should, you know, jibe with the real world, but I just think it's sort of helpful in understanding some of the dynamics that create problems for women existing in groups with guys that sort of fit that category. And I think a lot of it comes from that sort of idea that they're playing with in The Big Bang Theory, that sort of quote-unquote geeky guys feel like women are these alien beings that, like, you know, in order to ever get laid, you have to learn the language to talk to them. And it's this one specific language that they think that if they can just crack the code and understand women, that they'll be good to go. I just think that causes a lot of the issues that we have.
Right. So it simultaneously stereotypes the geek and women.
Absolutely.
And do you want to say exactly what Bill Prady said?
Oh, sure. And then later on in his talk, he made this joke. His general theme was about being a skeptic without being an asshole. And he gave an example of if you go into a bar as a guy and you're chatting up a girl and she asks you what your sign is, you should do a test and half the time explain to her why astrology is bullshit and the other half of the time just tell her she has pretty eyes and see how many times you get anywhere. It was probably innocently meant, and as you know, he did respond to us with a note basically saying he could have reversed the genders. He didn't mean it as a sexist joke, which is fair enough. But to me, it indicates a lack of understanding of his audience. I mean, it felt to me and a lot of the women in the room that he didn't see us at all. Like we weren't even there. And it really felt excluding to a lot of us.
Yeah, the women in the audience definitely all seem to exchange glances in that moment and say, you know, actually, if a guy came up to me and said I had pretty eyes, I would ignore him and his empty platitudes. But if a guy were to start up a conversation about interesting research, that would be much more interesting and attractive to me. So what woman is this guy talking about? And I think we all had this idea of the person that he might have in mind. And it was, you're right, Carrie, when viewed in context with what we had just seen with the television clips and everything, that it definitely came across as, I only understand women to be this type of woman, where she's not interested in science. She's only interested in, you know, looks and shallower things. I think we all kind of shared that moment where suddenly we felt like something other than the men.
That's definitely the TV Land stereotype, right? That's what you get.
And I don't want to get hung up on the particular politics of the show. I just think that some of the stereotypes in the show are indicative of what is happening in real life.
Right,
and
right.
in that sense, I think we can maybe learn from it and sort of use it as a mirror in a little, you know, as an exaggerated mirror of what's really going on and try to use that knowledge to have a discussion.
And
I agree.
Bill Prady
Absolutely.
Has brought up the idea that it's not his job to present a fair view of scientists, and it's not his job to speak up for feminists and for female scientists. But I think that it's just taking the easy road out to ignore that segment of the population. And I think that so many other shows do a wonderful job of showing nerdy women like Mythbusters. You know, look at, even though it's two guys that started out, you know, the whole thing, you've got like Carrie, who steps up and she's awesome. You know, she's nerdy and fun and artsy. She's pretty much everything. And she's a real person.
But why don't we talk a little bit more about TAM itself, though? Because it's, you know, biggest meeting of the skeptical movement. You basically have skeptical culture right there. What's it like from the female perspective? I would have thought that, you know, at this point in time with the skeptical movement, that it would be a pretty egalitarian, pretty open environment for women. But, of course, I have the perspective of a guy. So what do you guys think about how do you feel as a woman in the skeptical movement at a meeting like TAM?
I feel generally with the community and the audience and everybody there, I feel pretty equal, and it seems like good things are happening and we're moving in the right direction. It seems to me, and I mean, I've only been to two TAM, so, you know, this, I'm kind of a noob, but it sort of seems like the programming is fairly entrenched, and it feels to me a little bit like a boys' club. And, you know, like I said, I'm a noob. I don't know the whole process or anything like that. But it seems like it's more difficult for women to get into the programming than men. And that may just be a function of fewer women being in the movement. But I'd like to see, you know, instead of, you know, one of the same old guys up there giving the same, essentially the same talk year after year, which, you know, to be fair, maybe some people come to see that. I'd much rather see some new faces. And, you know, I'm not saying I am advocating tokenism, but I would love to see some more women up there.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that it's interesting where I certainly never feel as though I'm, put down because of being a woman at TAM. I always have a great time, and I always get along very well with, as Carrie said, with the rest of the community that comes out. But Steve, you know, you mentioned that you go and it seems all very egalitarian and everything seems fair. But I do think that part of that comes from being a white male who can see an entire conference of white males and not really notice that there's anything amiss. Once you, as a woman, like one of the first things I just happen to notice is that there's only one woman on the list of speakers, Jennifer Ouellette. And then Harriet Hall was on a panel, I think, and that was it. And you know, we're talking about sexism here, not anything else, but every single speaker and on every single panel included was white. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not actually representative of the scientific community, of the rationalist community. There are so many other people there who are female, who are black or Hispanic or Indian. I think that it's not, of course, it's not a focus of TAM to be diverse. I don't think that's anywhere near the top of their priorities, but I think that it should be in the coming years. I think that it would be fantastic if they would start focusing on just being like the largest conference out there for skeptics right now, that there's this certain responsibility to do a good job of representing the community and presenting an interesting mix of backgrounds and viewpoints.
Well, in their defense, though, I mean, you know, I happen to know that when they were putting together the speaker list for TAM 7, they asked me directly. They said, we want more women in the lineup for TAM 7. For whatever reason this year, it just worked out that, you know, a lot of the women that they invited to speak couldn't make it. And they said, give us some names. Tell us some women so we could have a little bit more balance in the speaker list. So they were very conscious of that. They were going out of their way to do that. It just didn't work out that way this year.
Well, and that brings up a really good point, too, just about what we as women can do. And like you said, you know, just in recruiting and, you know, getting speaking up and saying, hey, this woman would be a really great speaker at TAM. Also, within the community, and a big part of what happened on my blog post was basically a bickering match about how to be an appropriate woman in skepticism. And I just think that does nothing to help us, because all we are doing is basically saying there's one way to be a woman in the movement, and then automatically you're excluding any other type of woman than the type of woman you are. And that is horrible and damaging, and we just can't do it. And I know it comes out of a place of insecurity and a place of just knowing how you have gotten where you are and just assuming that everyone else should do the same. And it in the big picture, it doesn't help.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And that was prompted by a blog post, and it wasn't the only one. I saw a few where people would talk about, you know, usually the younger crowd that was starting to come out to TAMS, because I think that every year we're getting a little younger and there's more, we are getting more diverse. You know, the community is starting to attract more people from alternative sort of paths, lifestyles. And I think that sort of freaked some people out. But I think it is something to be embraced, because if you look at it, I mean, Sue Blackmore, I think, is a great example of somebody who does not come across as anything approaching conservative. But, you know, she's an awesome skeptic with some interesting ideas that could contribute to the skeptical community. And I think it's important that we not reject people like that.
Rebecca, you mentioned the increasing diversity, and I have a lot of hope for that in the future, especially I remember specifically this year they mentioned the percentage of women that signed up for TAM was up from like every other year. Was it 40%?
I don't think it's quite to 40 yet.
But it was the biggest.
Yeah, definitely. I think every year, I think. And also it's not just the fact that there are more women in the seats, but that you see so many more women who are excited to be there and who are not, say, just a spouse who's been dragged along.
Oh, absolutely.
And in fact, there were a number of women who I met who came up and said, oh, I had to come and I dragged along my husband, you know, and that to me was really cool.
Do you think that there's any lingering sexism within skepticism itself?
I think there definitely is. You know, like we were saying, I think it's kind of on the way out, but I really tend to think of the women in skepticism problem as a social problem more than an intellectual problem or a how do we communicate better problem. I think it has everything to do with how people have historically joined the movement, and as internet and podcasts and different things like that create these online communities, I just think we're going to see more and more women come in. And I don't know.
I don't think it's ever a case of men that are trying to keep women out of the skeptical community or anything like that.
Do you feel that you were held back in any way, or you think it's more of those kind of sort of unconscious, just like stereotyping type sexism that you see?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, that's an interesting way to put things, because would you feel held back if someone just constantly told you that you needed to be both smart and pretty and nice all the time? You know, it's not this thing where it's like, oh, we're not going to read your blog because you're a woman, or you're not allowed to do such and such because you're a woman. It's this, you know, it's a much more, a much quieter, slightly more insidious kind of sexism, where you can respond to it by shrinking and going away, which I think a lot of people do, or you can respond to it by standing up and being a bitch. and I mean that in the nicest sense of the term. And I hope that that's what we're encouraging people to do, is to stand up, point it out when it happens. And I don't know if you feel the same, Carrie, but I feel that the more we point it out, like, no, that wasn't okay, you shouldn't say things like that, now let's move forward, the better off we'll be.
Well, yeah, and I mean, by no means should we sort of label these, you know, people that may say silly, offensive things sometimes as jerks, or, you know, it's happened, maybe you weren't aware what you were really saying there, or how it would be interpreted. Let's move on. You learn from it, and let's all just try to...
And don't do it again.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, so there's, as you say, there's a softer kind of bigotry with that, but it still can have the impact of just making an unwelcoming environment for women at skeptical events like that.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and I think we just need to keep talking about it. I think that's really the key. Just keep talking about it.
Well, it's been a very interesting discussion. Thanks for joining us, Carrie.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Carrie.
Thank you, Carrie.
It's been fun, guys.
Have a good night.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fictitious. I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake.
Did you say fictitious?
Did I?
I'm pretty sure that's not a word.
I wasn't listening.
Oh, it's a perfectly cromulent word.
All right. You need to stop using that as the go-to joke.
Still funny.
Funny is funny.
All right, here we go. Item number 1. New studies find that most people grossly overestimate their ability to resist temptation. Item number 2, a new study finds that daily use of kefir, a fermented milk drink rich in probiotics, is associated with a decreased risk of autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. And item number 3, a new study finds that 70% of U.S. children are deficient in vitamin D. Evan, go first.
Well, the first one, with new studies that find most people grossly overestimate their ability to resist temptation. I think that one is correct, because I think people grossly overestimate a lot of things that have to do with themselves. I think we have bad perspective. We're not able to step outside ourselves, as it were, and take a real hard look at how we, you know, act day to day, or what other forces are at work, what kind of hardwiring is going on in our brain that prevents us from being able to do these kinds of things. So I think that's correct. And then number 2 was the new study finding the daily use of kefir?
K-E-F-I-R.
A fermented milk drink rich in probiotics. Blah. Associated with a decreased risk of autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. Wow. I'm not so sure about that one. That one, I don't know. It seems a little opaque to me. And then the last one, the new study finds that 70% of U.S. children are deficient in vitamin D. I can believe that. We've gone from generations of drinking water and milk to drinking water, milk, sodas, juices, Sobe, and all these other crazy things that are out there and available. And I think, you know, I might be simplifying this, but that would probably lead to that deficiency in vitamin D. I think that's correct. So I'll say the daily use of kefir. That one is fiction.
Okay, Bob?
All right, the first one, people grossly overestimate their ability to resist temptation. Yeah, that just makes a lot of sense. And the second one, see, you left yourself some wiggle room here with the milk, because I'm thinking that you're thinking that the probiotics is going to set off an alarm for us, but you're saying that, first off, you need to drink it daily. Secondly, it's associated with a decreased risk of autoimmune diseases. So it could be very slightly decreased risk. So I'm going to say that one is science. This third one, though, 70% of children are deficient in vitamin D. 70? That's a lot of rickets. I'm not buying that. That just seems way too high to me. One of the classic responses to people that say, oh, you need multivitamins, is that go to the hospital. How many people are there for vitamin deficiency? Not many, because it's just, you know, vitamin deficiency isn't really a huge problem. But that does say it's a new study. I'm still not buying it, even if drinking milk is down. I mean, I hate milk. I never get a glass of milk. I have milk with cereal. That's about it. Even as a kid, I hated it. I had to drink chocolate milk. I could not drink regular milk at school. So I'm going to say that one is the fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, Bob makes a good point. I originally thought that one would be science because, you know, it's the internet's fault. Children, they're staying inside. They're not getting any sun. To me, it's not a milk problem. It's a sunlight problem. But that said, 70% are deficient. That's a really high amount. And while I do believe that there is a problem with children getting appropriate levels of vitamin D, I don't think 70% would be that bad off. So compared to the others, people grossly overestimate their ability to resist temptation. I don't know about new studies, but I mean, I know that I think it was in Stumbling on Happiness. The author writes quite a bit about how humans just kind of naturally lack this ability to place themselves in a future circumstance and to adequately gauge how they feel. And they always tend to misjudge their emotions, and they always think they're going to act more logically than they do. And probiotics helping with arthritis, I can believe, because, you know, yogurt, is there anything it can't do? Yeah, probiotics in general are very good for you, so I can certainly see that they could help out with something like arthritis. So, yeah, I'm going to side with Bob on this one and say that 70%, too many kids there. That's fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that new studies find that most people grossly overestimate their ability to resist temptation is science. And that one is science. Not very surprising. A couple of things interesting about this. So this is a series of studies that shows, first of all, that people will underestimate their response to temptation, meaning that if they are trying to lose weight and they are in a situation where there's food, they think, I'll be able to resist the food, when in fact they can't. Or if they're trying to quit smoking or whatever, or drugs, or whatever it is they're trying to resist, they think that if they're in that situation where they're tempted, they're very confident in their self-control. Usually they're overconfident in their self-control. They also found that increased confidence in one's self-control in the face of temptation actually correlated with giving into the urges even more susceptibility to those temptations, which makes sense because, you know, it's overconfidence. They don't think – they're not prepared for the temptation because they think that, hey, I have the self-control. So it takes their response to it takes them by surprise. And also they're setting themselves up for failure. They're more likely to put themselves in temptation's way because they're confident they're going to be able to resist it. Whereas if you have a more realistic sense of your own susceptibility to temptation, let's say you're trying to control your caloric intake, and you're not going to buy the Twinkies and leave them in your house, right? Because you think, I won't be able to resist them and late at night when I'm hungry.
But if
you think you can, you will be able to resist it. You're more likely to, you know, to have the Twinkies in your house, right?
Yeah,
indeed.
Or to go out with friends who are drinking, or whatever it is that you're trying to avoid. So very interesting. Let's go to item number two. A new study finds that daily use of kefir, a fermented milk drink rich in probiotics, is associated with a decreased risk of autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. Evan, you thought this one was the fiction. Mm-hmm. Bob and Rebecca, you both thought this one was science. And this one is fiction.
Ah.
Good job, Evan.
Yeah, smelled it. Smelled sour.
Right. Now, this is a claim that is, in fact, made for probiotics, and specifically this fermented milk product as kefirs. But there's no studies published that show that it actually modifies autoimmune diseases, specifically rheumatoid arthritis. I did a PubMed search. I did a Google search. I could find a lot of claims, but no studies supporting that whatsoever. There was a recent study, though, looking at the use of kefir to prevent diarrhea in children using antibiotics. This is actually a much more straightforward application of this. Now, when people use antibiotics, they often get diarrhea because the antibiotics kill off their intestinal bacteria, leaving them more susceptible to diarrhea-producing bacteria to overgrow because they're not being crowded out by the more benign bacteria. The thinking with taking probiotics is that you replace the bacteria that's being killed by the antibiotics, and that will crowd out any harmful bacteria and prevent the diarrhea. Studies, however, have shown that generally probiotics don't make that much of a difference. That maybe, there's like weak evidence that maybe if you take the really robust high probiotic count products at the very beginning of a course of antibiotics, you may reduce your symptoms a little bit, but it doesn't really affect the long-term outcome. So again, there's this really equivocal mild effect from high-dose probiotics only when used very, very early. The problem is, and I know we talked about this with Mark Krislip, and he has a Quackcast that's dedicated to this topic, is that we have a complex ecosystem of bacteria, and just throwing in one or two or even three or four cultures of bacteria, it doesn't really do much for the ecosystem. It's got to recover on its own. What this study looked at was just, again, just the use of this product for diarrhea in children, and it found no advantage. No effect from using this probiotic product. However, the author said that there was possibly an advantage. If you just separate out the sickest children, there may have been a small advantage for them. But the study wasn't really designed up front to look at that subpopulation. You know, when you do retrospective subpopulation analysis, as it's called, it's tricky because you can often find, just by chance, correlations that look significant, but they really aren't. So
I want to get to the last one because I think you're wrong.
What this really means is that, as the authors say, we need to do another study, right? I love it when they always conclude, we need more money to do more studies, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
But no effect. That was the bottom line.
All right, get to the last one because I think
you're wrong. A new study finds that 70% of U.S. children are deficient in vitamin D is science.
No, it is not. I read that article and it said like 20%. I swear to God, it said like 20%.
You're not supposed to.
I read this article. I read it earlier today, and it was like 15 to 20 that were considered deficient.
Oh, it's 70% are vitamin D insufficient.
Exactly.
Yeah, I shouldn't use the term deficient.
From Reuters. Inadequate vitamin D levels common in U.S. children.
We're inadequate, yeah.
9% were classified as deficient in vitamin D.
I should have been more careful in the terminology I was using because you are correct. It was 61% were vitamin D insufficient and 9% were deficient. I didn't realize they were making a distinction there. They just said in the title, I think they said 70% were vitamin D had inadequate vitamin D levels, and I incorrectly translated
that
into deficient.
See, that's why you should read news sources with better headline writers, because the one I read said 9.
Yeah, so I guess there were two fictions this week, I guess we have to call it.
I double win.
Oh, I like that resolution. Yeah. Groovy.
Yeah, so
Bob
you guys
and
all
I
double
win.
Fiction.
Right.
Is that like double Jeopardy on?
No, I just need to be more. Usually, I'm trying to be very careful with the wording, and I screwed up.
Yes, you have a great track record, but yeah. You know, once in
211,
you could screw up on these.
Yeah. You know what? Let's not lose sight of what's important, which is that Steve was wrong.
That's true.
Wow.
I'm sorry, Steve.
No, I did. I caught up in the terminology. It was.
I was sure you were pulling a sneaky one too, because I'm like, oh, 70%. Well played, Mr. Novella.
Yeah, that's. I usually wouldn't do something that subtle.
Yeah, that's true. But still, you're wrong.
Yeah. But it still is interesting that 70% of U.S. children have insufficient levels of vitamin D.
That still is very high.
I don't know if I would have gotten, maybe for not you, Rebecca, if you actually read the study, but I don't know if I would have gotten Bob on that one.
We'll never know. Will we?
Be careful with the terminology. part of this is because recent evidence suggests that that we needed to raise the level of what is a normal level. Mm. And the recommendations, in fact, for how much vitamin D people should be getting was recently doubled from 200 international units a day to 400 international units per day.
Oh. Wow.
They raised
and
the bar.
That's not fair.
Yeah, right. You can't go raising the bar in the middle of the whole thing.
Rebecca was right, again, obviously because you read the article, that it probably has more to do with lack of sunlight exposure and not so much drinking less milk.
Although, the internet.
Yep, milk is a source of vitamin D because it's fortified with vitamin D. But it's hard to drink, so you need to drink like a gallon of milk a day to get all the vitamin
You'd
D
vomit.
You need from that. So, you only need about 15 minutes of exposure to sunshine in order to get the amount of vitamin D that you need for the day.
So, unchain the children, let them out of the basement is the moral of the story.
Yeah, so the recommendations are to get a little bit more sun exposure, but to use sunscreen for any prolonged sun exposure, but brief sun exposure, you probably don't need to be obsessive about the sunscreen. And that kids probably just need to play outside more and be less attached to their computer screens and televisions and iPods and whatnot. So that is true. And there is a large body of recent evidence showing, linking vitamin D insufficiency or deficiency to increased risk of heart disease, of hypertension, of even certain neurological disorders like multiple sclerosis, for example.
Wow.
This has led to sort of a reconsideration of, well, what is the optimal level of vitamin D? And it's probably higher than what we were previously recommending. So new evidence came in. The recommendations have changed. Also, I will mention, several months ago, I did a science or fiction news item on vitamin D, and I used a study. It was actually a fairly a dense, sort of basic science study looking at the role of vitamin D in the immune system. And then what I wasn't aware of at the time was that the study was published by this group attached to this guy, Dr. Marshall. You guys familiar with this guy at all?
Author
of the Marshall Protocol. It turns out it's probably bunk. That this is sort of this one dedicated group that it has this notion that a lot of problems are caused by excessive vitamin D. And it really is, again, one of these minority on the fringe opinions that really hasn't made its convincing case to the scientific community. So if I had known that, I probably wouldn't have used that item because it does make it seem a little bit more dubious. You couldn't tell from reading the study because it's kind of a basic science study just about how vitamin D affects immune regulation. However, Mark Crislip did write a good review on the Marshall Protocol on science-based medicine. So if you want to get the skinny on it, you can read his review.
Yay, Mark.
But you just read an isolated study, it seems perfectly legitimate. But unless you put it into context, sometimes you don't know where the authors, the researchers are coming from. So good job, everybody. I guess you all won.
Yay! Maybe next week all three will be fiction.
Maybe.
All depends on how fast we get.
We're sure to win then.
So, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
It is. Let's play last week's Who's That Noisy? It was a recording of a bottlenose dolphin.
Oh.
Could you believe that?
Did anyone guess that?
Crazy talk.
No, nobody got it.
Yeah, I didn't remember seeing anyone guess that one.
I figured, I was some marine biologist I figured would chime in and say, oh, I know exactly what that is. I've heard that 1,000 times. Nope. Nobody guessed it.
You all failed.
It didn't sound like Flipper, though.
No, it was a non-typical sounding dolphin.
Yeah.
That was non-typical, I think, as I could find. So that's why it made a good noisy.
Okay. Yeah, so it wasn't that typical dolphin noise we're used to hearing. That's like
right.
The one sound clip, I guess,
right,
that we always hear on TV.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Oh, that's a dolphin.
Maybe for this one they were cursing.
Is it recursing, right? Well, Evan, what do you have for us this week?
All right, this week. Well, why don't I just, you know, cue it up and just let it play. Let's see what we have.
Your birthday today, Daisy. This year, you have to make a choice between two life paths. Second chances come your way. Extraordinary events culminate in what might seem to be an anti-climax. Your lucky numbers are 84, 23, 11, 78, and 99. What a load of shit.
There you go. If anybody knows who that noisy is, send it in. Let us know. Good luck.
Well, thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
It's always interesting.
Yep.
So I'm going to do the quote this week since Jay isn't here. This was a quote suggested to us by listener Peter McCulley. This comes from the show Dexter, and I remember hearing this line on Dexter and noting it myself. It is a good one. This comes from the character Vincent Masuka, and he is a forensic scientist working for this homicide department. And Masuka said, "Your victim was smothered. That's not opinion. That's science. And science is one cold-hearted bitch with a 14-inch strap on."
Man, that's a little saucy. We're a family
especially
podcast.
Vincent Masuka. I know.
Huh. Wow.
I don't remember a Vincent Masuka on Dexter's Laboratory.
That's something else entirely.
Oh, it's a serial killer episode. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before we wrap things up, I have a small announcement. Our forum at suforums.com is adminned by one Beleth, a.k.a. Doug, and today's his birthday.
Oh, yeah. Happy birthday, Doug.
Happy birthday.
And good work.
That's all.
And we have started putting the more juicy forum threads into our Twitter feed. So if you follow us on Twitter... And we do announce things like exactly when the show goes up and 5x5 goes up. And, you know, sometimes we throw some other funny stuff in there and make other kinds of announcements. But we're also going to point you in the direction of some of the more popular and juicy forum threads. So one more reason to follow us on Twitter. And thanks to the forum mods for helping us out with that one.
Word.
Don't forget about the Northeastern Conference on Science and Skepticism coming up on September 12th. And the SGU crew will be at DragonCon for Labor Day weekend if you're going to be in Atlanta, Georgia for DragonCon. And don't forget, you can buy our latest SGU Uncut episode. Go to the SGU homepage and then from there to the SGU store and you'll see the Uncut. We now have 5-hour-long Uncut episodes of SGU for download.
And don't forget the G-Hunters on YouTube.
And it's unfortunate that Jay's not here because to talk about the G-Hunters is now up on YouTube. It's in two parts, each about 10 minutes long. The overall video is 20 minutes. You can find it on the Skeptics Guide channel on YouTube. Rebecca, you also linked to it from your blog, and I linked to it from the Rogues Gallery. So check it out if you haven't seen it yet. It's pretty funny. And if you like it, please email every single person in your email address book and ask them to watch it as well.
Absolutely.
Get the word out. Well, thanks for joining me again this week, guys.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Nighty-long.
Bye, Jay.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.